Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, March 31st, 2022. Here are some of the day's headlines. President Joe Biden announcing the U.S. will release 1 million barrels of oil per day for the next 6 months from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to bring down high prices of gasoline. The high prices, the president says, because of the disruption to the markets caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Coming up, we'll hear from the president and talk with a Wall Street Journal energy policy reporter Tim Pucco about whether the president's plan will work. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says he's going to vote no on Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Graham was one of three Republican senators who voted yes last year to confirm Jackson to her current post on the federal appeals court. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell confirming the latest emergency COVID-19 program spending package under negotiation is now $10 billion, down $5 billion. Due to an inability to agree to cut other programs to offset the cost. And the U.S. House moving to pass a bill to lower the price of insulin for patients who rely on it to a maximum of $35 per month. This from CNN. President Joe Biden on Thursday announced an unprecedented release of oil from U.S. reserves and several steps administration is taking to punish oil companies for not increasing production from unused leases on federal land. President spoke in the Eisenhower Executive Office building next to the White House.
Right now, oil and gas industry is sitting on nearly 9,000 unused but approved permits for production on federal lands, or more than a million unused acres they have a right to pump on. Families can't afford that companies sit on these their hands. So, to help execute this first part of my plan, I'm calling for a use-it-or-lose-it policy. Congress should make companies pay fees on wells on federal leases they haven't used in years, and acres of public land they're hoarding without production. Companies that are already producing from these wells won't be affected, but those sitting on unused leases and idle wells will either have to start producing or pay the price for their inaction. Look, the action I'm calling for will make a real difference over time. But the truth is, it takes months, not days, for companies to increase production. That's why the next part of my plan is so important. Today, I'm authorizing the release of 1 million barrels per day for the next 6 months, over 180 million barrels, from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. This is a wartime bridge to increase oil supply until production ramps up later this year. And it is by far the largest release of our national reserve in our history. It will provide a historic amount of supply for a historic amount of time, a six-month bridge to the fall. And we'll use the revenue from selling the oil now to restock the Strategic Petroleum Reserve when prices are lower. So we'll be ready. We'll be ready for future emergencies. Folks, I've coordinated this release with allies and partners around the world. Already, we have commitments from other countries to release tens of millions of additional barrels into the market. Together, our combined efforts will supply well over a million barrels a day. Nations coming together to deny Putin the ability to weaponize his energy resources against American families and families in democracies around the world. Now, for the first part of my plan is about meeting an immediate crisis. The second part is about declaring real American energy independence in the long term, so that we never have to deal with this problem again. Ultimately, we and the whole world need to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels altogether.
President Biden in the Eisenhower Executive Office building. The Energy Department explains that the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is a U.S. government complex of four sites with deep underground storage caverns created in salt domes along the Texas and Louisiana Gulf coasts, created in the 1970s during the oil shocks. U.S. uses about 20 million barrels of oil per day, and that's about 20% of the world's consumption of 100 million barrels. AAA saying the average cost of a gallon of gasoline in the U.S. is $4.23, higher in the western states, lower in the middle part of the country, and that's up from $2.87 a gallon last year. President Biden today asked how much and how soon what he announced today will bring down the prices.
How much in monetary terms do you estimate today's announcement will reduce gas prices, and when can Americans expect to see these changes?
That's a really important question, and there's no firm answer to it. But prices already came down when it was announced ahead of time that Biden was going to release so much and so much energy from so many barrels of oil from the Spro. They're already come down. My guess is we'll see it come down, continue to come down. But how far down, I don't think anyone can tell. And there's going to be a slight delay, because if you go out there and you're a gas station and you purchased X amount of gas at a certain price, you're not going to lower the price of the pump until you're able to get back what you invested. And that, I'm talking matter of, I think, you know, days and weeks. But it's hard to tell. And the other thing is, exact, but it will come down. And it could come down fairly significantly. It could come down the better part of, you know, anything from 10 cents to 35 cents a gallon. It's unknown at this point. I'm also waiting to see whether or not our allies, exactly how many barrels they release from their supplies now. My guess is it could be as high, somewhere between 30 million to 50 million barrels. And the higher the number, the more likely the prices to come down. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
More on President Biden's announcements on energy. Tim Pucco is an energy policy reporter at the Wall Street Journal's Washington, D.C. Bureau. Thanks for joining us. President announcing 1 million barrels a day for 6 months, 180 million barrels total to be released. And you write it's an unprecedented government intervention into oil markets at a time of international crisis. Really unprecedented, huh?
We've never had a release from the U.S. Emergency Reserve that is this large, and not even one that's this close to it. I think Clearview Energy Partners estimated that this would be, if they do the whole thing, it would come out about 3.6 times larger than anything the U.S. government has done before in terms of releasing something from government-owned reserves.
The president said it could bring down gasoline prices in the U.S. by as much as 35 cents. Is that possible?
You know, I'll tell you, when I heard him say that, he seemed to be speaking off the cuff a little bit. Sure, anything is possible in commodity markets, but I found it much more telling that he said that, you know, we don't really exactly know what's going to happen. Gasoline markets have been incredibly stubborn in recent weeks, even as oil prices have come down. And a lot of the analysts that I'm talking to say, you know, what you might get at best is like a 5 to 10 cent a gallon reduction. But, you know, a lot of that remains to be seen.
The president today also saying he wants Congress to impose financial penalties on oil and gas companies that lease public lands, but then are not producing oil. At the same time, Republicans in Congress are complaining that new drilling permits are not being approved. Can you help us sort that out?
Sure. The permit issue and how quickly these oil companies are drilling on federal lands has become something that the administration has really seized on in recent weeks. They constantly cite the fact that there are several thousand permits out there that are already approved for leases on federal lands that oil companies aren't using. What the oil industry explains is, you know, that's relatively common. There's always a certain amount of churn where they get these leases. They drill some of them right away as it works under market conditions. Others wait as they figure out, you know, what are the most profitable areas to drill, what works logistically. And the oil industry has claimed that, in fact, 9,000 is actually a relatively low number for them. So, you know, there's a lot of tension between these two groups right now. The industry has been reluctant at times to drill. They're not getting the money from Wall Street that they used to get. In part, that's because they haven't delivered in recent years like they used to deliver. They haven't delivered profits, that's for sure. And so, you know, companies are a little bit, or I should say investors are a little bit burned out on these companies. And so how quickly they're getting out there, you know, there's a lot of reluctance from the industry, but a lot of frustration with that from the government.
We're talking with Tim Pucco from The Wall Street Journal. Several news stories today making reference to high energy prices being a political liability in an election year. And at the same time, the left wing of the Democratic Party is against further use of fossil fuels. The president needs to walk a fine line here. What's at stake?
His entire agenda, arguably. The biggest things that he wants to do all have to go through Congress. You know, I've covered the climate legislation closely of all the different things, and that's certainly been one of the struggles. He promised as a candidate $2 trillion for climate initiatives. He's shrunk that down. I think at last count, the more ambitious proposal that was out there was about $555 billion, and even that has failed to get through the Senate. The margins of Democratic control throughout Congress are very slim, and they are not polling well. So if Democrats, led by the president, continue to poll poorly, they might lose what margins, what control they do have of Congress. And so as tough as it's already been for the president to get his agenda through with those lawmakers, if things get worse and they lose many, many midterm elections, you could see what has been a slow progress come to a full standstill.
Tim Pucco is an energy policy reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Find his stories at WSJ.com and on Twitter at Tim Pucco, P-U-K-O. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And President Biden also announcing he'll invoke the Defense Production Act to encourage domestic production of minerals required to make batteries for electric vehicles and long-term energy storage, part of his plan to reduce the U.S. reliance on fossil fuels. Republican Congressman Tom Emmer of Minnesota saying on the House floor today that the president has taken the wrong approach to energy policy and there are better ways to reduce gas prices.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to address a crisis eroding the budgets of hardworking Americans. Earlier this month, the price of unleaded gasoline rose to the highest level on record, and President Biden's anti-energy policies are directly responsible. On the campaign trail, Joe Biden promised to end fossil fuels. Since assuming office, President Biden has worked to make good on that promise, imposing 81 individual anti-energy policies. Coincidentally, the price of gasoline has risen 81% since the beginning of his presidency. Analysts estimate that President Biden's anti-energy agenda will cost American families an additional $2,000 per year in gasoline costs alone. This is staggering for the 64% of Americans who live paycheck to paycheck thanks to rising costs. President Biden claims he can't do much right now to reduce gas prices. This simply is not true. President Biden can end the federal freeze on new oil and gas projects, fast-track LNG export permits, expedite approval of all pipeline and energy development, and stop the regulatory barrage on U.S. energy development. There is so much that can and should be done right now, and this crusade against American energy dominance must end.
Congressman Tom Emmer, Republican from Minnesota, on the House floor. Wall Street today, the Dow down 550, NASDAQ falling 221, S&P down 72. Today is the last day of the first quarter of the year, and for that first quarter, the Dow is down 4.6%, NASDAQ down 9%, S&P down 4.9%. President Biden saying in his energy announcements that a good amount of the recent price increase in gas is due to Russia's war in Ukraine. Associated Press reporting that Russian forces continued to shell Kyiv suburbs Thursday, 2 days after the Kremlin announced it would significantly scale back operations near both the capital and the northern city of Chernihiv. As President Biden was leaving that announcement on energy, reporters asked him about whether Russian forces are indeed withdrawing, and also reports that Russian President Vladimir Putin may have ordered some of his advisors fired or placed under house arrest.
My question is pulling back his forces.
From
whoever asked
that question.
The question of whether he's pulling back his forces depends on how you read exactly what's going on. Thus far, there is no clear evidence that he's pulling all of his forces out of Kyiv. There is also evidence that he is beefing up his troops down in the Donbass area. Depending on your view of Putin, I'm a little skeptical. It's an open question whether he's actually pulling back and going to say, I'm just going to focus on the Donbass and I'm not worried about the rest of the country. I'm a skeptic, but I don't have proof that in fact he is not going, he's taking a pause, doing all he can to use all the troops he has in the Donbass and continue to keep an eye on and try to move beyond the rest of the country. Don't know the answer, but it appears so far that he has not pulled all of his, the idea he's pulling all of his troops out from around Kyiv and moving south. There's no evidence that he's done that.
President Biden in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. RT.com, the Russian government-funded news site, writes, the Kremlin said on Thursday the claims of President Vladimir Putin being misled by his own military only prove how little the U.S. really knows about Russia. The response came after the White House and the Pentagon suggested that officials were afraid to speak the truth to Putin about the performance of the Russian army in Ukraine. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters he was dismayed by claims that advisors had misled the president. He said, as it turns out, neither the State Department nor the Pentagon have any real information on what is going on in the Kremlin. They simply do not understand President Putin, don't understand the decision-making mechanism, and don't understand the work we do. That from RT. At the Pentagon today, Press Secretary John Kirby giving the latest on the Russian military movements in Ukraine at his briefing with reporters.
We continue to see indications that that they are moving a small number. I don't have an update for you in terms of what that equates to. I think yesterday we said it was about 20%, maybe a little less. I don't think we would change that estimation much over the last 24 hours. It has not been wholesale by any means, or has it been rapid? We do believe that, again, that a small number are beginning to reposition. It's not exactly clear, Bob, where they're going to go, for how long, and for what purpose. But we don't see any indication that they're going to be sent home. The best assessment we have, and it's an assessment at this early stage, is that they're going to be repositioned probably into Belarus to be refit and resupplied and used elsewhere in Ukraine. Again, where is that elsewhere? We don't exactly know. All I can tell you is what we've said now for several days, that it's clear the Russians want to reprioritize their operations in the Donbas area. That could be one destination, but again, too soon to know. We don't really have a good sense of it. You were asking about Chernobyl. We have seen indications that some Russian forces are departing the Chernobyl plant facility. Again, we gather that they are leaving to the north to go back again towards Belarus. But again, indications are not completely clear at this time. I think you were asking, is that of a piece or is it something separate? We would assess at this early stage that it's of a piece of this larger effort to refit and resupply, and not necessarily done because of health hazards or some sort of emergency or a crisis at Chernobyl. That would be our assessment.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby. Associated Press writes that the International Atomic Energy Agency says it has been informed by Ukraine that the Russian forces that were in control of the Chernobyl nuclear plant have, in writing, transferred control of the facility to Ukrainian personnel. This is Washington Today. Reuters reports that U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai deflected a barrage of complaints from Democratic and Republican senators on Thursday that the Biden administration's Indo-Pacific economic plan to counter China will not include a free trade deal that lowers tariffs. Tai, testifying before the Tax and Trade-focused Senate Finance Committee, said the Indo-Pacific economic framework would not lower tariffs for member countries, but would nonetheless offer economically meaningful outcomes to promote trade and market access. That reporting from Reuters. Here's some of the hearing covered by C-SPAN. Questions from Senator Rob Portman, Republican from Ohio, to the U.S. Trade Rep, Katherine Tai.
With regard to China and your discussion and your testimony about the need to use existing tools, you refer to the Phase One agreement as part of the old playbook because China has not lived up to its commitments. And I get that. It's frustrating when China doesn't live up to its commitments. But I don't think we can just move along and say, so let's start to work on other ways in which we can open more opportunities. Instead, I think we have to stick with that agreement and use what's in the agreement, which is dispute resolution. I think if we just say we're going to forget that and make that part of the old playbook, I think it sends a terrible message, because I think when China makes an agreement with us and they don't fulfill their obligations, we have to exercise our legal rights under that. And I think it's going to be much more difficult to make progress with China on the subsidies, on state-owned enterprises, on suppression of labor rights, and other things if we don't insist that the agreement be adhered to. So I guess my question to you would be, are you willing to move forward with dispute resolution. Are you willing to commit to utilizing the dispute resolution process that the United States enjoys as part of that Phase One agreement, possibly culminating in restrictions on trade with China as necessary to enforce the agreement?
Senator Portman, it's always a pleasure to see you. On your question on China, I appreciate the opportunity to clarify my position and what I've said, because I have seen it reported perhaps a bit inaccurately, which is to say it is a time to turn the page on the old playbook, which focused exclusively on pressuring China and seeking China to change its ways, or, you know, pressing China for compliance. We are not giving up on pressing China on compliance or on changing its ways. And yes, all tools remain on the table with respect to dispute settlement and enforcement. But my main point is that that's not the only thing we can do now. And we have to expand our strategy to include developing the tools that we need to defend the interests of our economy. So in fact, what I'm saying is we're committing to doing more work, and our strategy needs to expand.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think using those existing tools we have are important. Again, setting a precedent of not using the dispute resolution tools that we have, I think would be problematic for China and others. Let me talk to you about new tools, because that's the other point that you make. You know, I've talked about this a lot. We just don't have the tools to keep up with China, in my view, as they try to undermine our national competitiveness. They're subsidizing manufacturing in many countries through their Belt and Road Initiative, and yet our trade enforcers are powerless to combat those subsidies. Our bipartisan legislation with Senator Brown called Level the Playing Field 2.0 contains new tools to deal with that reality. I mean, it's what's happening out there, the transshipments and particularly the Belt and Road subsidies. That bill is something I'm pushing very hard, as you know, to have included, as it is in the House version, in the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act we talked about earlier. Thank you for your support of this approach. Can you explain to the committee how this legislation would help to combat China's unfair trade practices?
Well, Senator Portman, let me begin by commending you and Senator Brown for working in a bipartisan way and bicamerally on this legislation and this initiative. In terms of how it would help us, I just want to emphasize that most of our trade enforcement tools date back to the 1970s and the 1980s, and it is critical that we retain those tools. But over time, as the global economy has evolved around us, our tools have not kept up. And so the updates and the enhancements that are in the Leveling the Playing Field Act 2.0 are exactly in the spirit of what we need right now, which is the tailoring of a tool set and expansion of a tool set that is going to be up to the task of meeting the challenges that we're facing today.
And with China in particular, would you agree?
Yes.
Catherine Tai is United States Trade Representative testifying before the Senate Finance Committee, questioned by Senator Rob Portman, Republican from Ohio. Tai referring to, Portman referring to Phase One trade deal, that's the United States and China deal that was signed under President Trump in January 2020. Tai also today declining to say if Taiwan will be invited to join the Biden administration's Indo-Pacific Economic Plan. You can find this full hearing archived at C-SPAN.org. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, one of three Republican senators who voted to confirm Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to her current post on the Federal Appeals Court 1 year ago, today saying he will vote no on her nomination to the Supreme Court. Senator Graham speaking on the Senate floor.
This morning, I'm going to announce my decision on Judge Jackson's nomination to the Supreme Court. I will oppose her and I will vote no. My decision is based upon her record of judicial activism, flawed sentencing methodology regarding child pornography cases, and a belief Judge Jackson will not be deterred by the plain meaning of the law when it comes to liberal causes. I find Judge Jackson to be a person of exceptionally good character, respected by our peers, and someone who has worked hard to achieve her current position. However, her record is overwhelming in its lack of a steady judicial philosophy and a tendency to achieve outcomes in spite of what the law requires or common sense would dictate. After a thorough review of Judge Jackson's record and information gained at the hearing from an evasive witness, I now know why Judge Jackson was the favorite of the radical left, and I will vote no.
Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, South Carolina, on the Senate floor. He's a member of the Judiciary Committee, which will be meeting Monday to vote on the nominee. A full Senate vote expected by the end of the week if she is reported out of committee. The chair of the Judiciary Committee is Democrat Dick Durbin of Illinois, and he followed Senator Graham on the floor today.
These charges that somehow she's soft on crime because she's an African-American woman and she was a public defender belie the actual record of this woman. We should all be judged on our records. This notion that we're asked to identify ourselves by labels, we know that story, the 100 of us who sit on this side of the chamber in the Senate. We are attached to labels which we embrace and some we don't embrace. But most people who are fair will say, I'm not going to judge you by your label. I'm going to judge you by your record. If you judge Ketanji Brown Jackson by her record, written opinions, the fact that this was the fourth time she appeared before the Judiciary Committee and been approved the three previous times, serving on the Sentence Commission and so many other things, you know that is an outstanding and stellar record, but you know it almost has to be. If you want to be the first, you have to be the best. She is the best. Despite some of the things that have been thrown at her today and in other places, the American people came out of that hearing and felt better and stronger about her nomination than before the hearing began. It is evidence of the strength that she brings to this nomination and the value that she will bring to the Supreme Court.
Senator Dick Durbin on the Senate floor. You can listen to the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting on Monday, 10 a.m. Eastern. Each senator will make remarks, and then they'll take a vote on the Supreme Court nominee, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. And then it's off to the Senate floor. We'll have coverage of that as well in a final vote. The Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is saying by the end of next week to confirm her. Besides Senator Graham, two other Senate Republicans voted to confirm Judge Jackson to her current position last year. Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. And Collins saying this week she'll vote yes to confirm Judge Jackson. So Murkowski has not announced how she will vote. Newsweek has an article about other senators on the Republican side who may vote yes. In addition to Lisa Murkowski, there is also Mitt Romney, Roy Blunt, Rob Portman, and Richard Burr. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. This from rollcall.com. Senators appear to be scaling back a proposed COVID-19 aid package to about $10 billion by eliminating a $5 billion foreign assistance component. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on Tuesday confirmed the developments from the discussions Wednesday evening, although no decisions are final. That from Roll Call. Senator McConnell was interviewed by Punchbowl News. The question coming from Anna Palmer, its co-founder.
Tell us what's going on there with COVID prep talks. Rand Paul has dropped his hold, but is still seeking a compromise. Romney's negotiating. What's the latest?
Yeah, Mitt and Roy Blunt and Richard Burr have been in the lead for us on this. And what we want to do, given the fact that we dropped $2 trillion on the economy last year, is to pay for the package. It's sort of still in kind of a work in progress, but as of late last night, it appeared as if that it would be skinny down from 15 to 10. Unfortunately, because the Democrats are unwilling to find another $5 billion out of this $2 trillion bill, about $100 billion of it, not out the door yet. So, and that has the potential to take out the international vaccine part, which I think is terribly unfortunate. But that's where we are at the moment. Whether that's going to completely come together is not clear. Romney's going to brief my conference at noon today on where he thinks we are.
Are you optimistic that it can get done by before the Easter recess?
We'll see. Hope so, hopefully.
Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, minority leader, Thursday morning in Washington, interviewed by Anna Palmer of Punchbowl News. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, who's taking part in these negotiations, later saying that they were getting close to a final agreement that could garner bipartisan support. More from the Roll Call article. They write, whatever the Senate is able to pass would have to get the House's approval next week before heading to President Joe Biden's desk. The White House requested $22.5 billion for COVID-19 response efforts earlier this month. So getting less than half of that in a final bill would deal a blow to the administration's efforts. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi asked about the developments during her briefing today.
On COVID relief, some Senate Republicans have suggested that the package could drop down to $10 billion, putting billions of dollars for global COVID vaccines on the chopping block. Would that compromise be acceptable to you? And are you confident that this could get done by Easter recess?
I think what the Republicans are doing is either they don't care or they don't know, but it is wrong. We must honor our force. We had a bigger package, and it's cut back to 15, that five that they said, so what? Stop the world, I want to get off. That's who they are. You don't know that, but that used to be a play. And so how can we say? We have said, we have pronounced, everyone knows, none of us safe unless all of us are safe. By the way, this is not enough money. We're going to even need more money. But because of the, I'm an appropriator, as you know, so that's my orientation, appropriations and intelligence. And appropriators left to their own devices can get this done. And they have ways of doing it. That is paid for. We agree. What should be paid for. But they will not accept the pay-fors that have been traditional in using budget outlays and the rest. This is shameful. We have to get the money. It's not going to last this past probably June 1st. So for them to just, I mean, they're making statements saying, well, this is not, we don't see this as a problem. It's a problem. It's a shame.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, at her weekly briefing on Capitol Hill. Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Illinois, tweeting today, hearing that critical global vax funding may be taken out of the COVID bill in the Senate. If the Senate does this, I'm concerned many others and I may not be able to support the bill. We can't end the pandemic without global vax funding, period. The U.S. House today passing a bill that would cap the cost of insulin to a patient to $35 a month or 25% of an insurance plan's negotiated price, whichever is lower. That applies to both Medicare and private health insurance. The sponsor is Congresswoman Angie Craig, Democrat from Minnesota.
Madam Speaker, diabetes does not care if you are a Republican or a Democrat. This disease is absolutely, an absolute torrential disease inside working families across our country. This bill has been mischaracterized by the other side. This would lead to a $35 cost for Americans, for Minnesotans, for Part D Medicare beneficiaries and commercial plan beneficiaries. For the vast majority of working families, the price of insulin is simply unsustainable. Many Americans are forced to risk their own lives by rationing doses or skipping treatments entirely. Today, we have an opportunity to save American families thousands of their hard-earned dollars. My bill, the Affordable Insulin Now Act, would cap it at $35 a month. Certainly, our work to lower drug costs and expand access to health care across this nation is not done. But this is a major step forward in the right direction and a chance to make good on our promises to the American people. I encourage all of my colleagues to vote yes. Thank you, and I yield the balance of my time.
Congresswoman Angie Craig, Democrat from Minnesota, on the House floor. About 30 million Americans have diabetes, and about 30% of those people take insulin to manage the condition. Kaiser Health News reports that drug companies have dramatically jacked up insulin prices in the United States, leaving Americans to pay more than 10 times as much as people in other developed countries, according to the most recent detailed survey by the federal government. Opposing the insulin price cap bill on the House floor, Kathy McMorris Rogers, Republican from Washington State.
We all share the goal of reducing the cost of insulin. This bill, however, is not the right answer. This is an attempt to revive Speaker Pelosi's proposed government price drug pricing scheme, part of a socialized medicine approach that would lead to fewer cures. It's the largest expansion of the federal government's role in private health insurance design since Obamacare. It will cost more than $11 billion over the next 10 years through higher subsidies for higher premiums. Just this morning, Axios reported, quote, legislation like the House bill from Representative Angie Craig that will be debated on the floor wouldn't address the core problem of rising cost of insulin. It would instead shift more cost onto health insurers and employers and result in higher premiums, according to experts. That means people who can't afford day-to-day life because of inflation and spending will face higher costs someplace else. Today, it's the government fixing the price on insulin. What's next? Gas? Food? History tells us that price fixing doesn't work. It shifts the problem someplace else. So the powerful has the excuse for more subsidies, more spending, and more control.
Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers, Republican from Washington State, on the House floor. Putting a limit on insulin prices, the subject of the standalone bill in the House today, was part of the multi-trillion dollar Build Back Better social spending agenda that President Biden and many Democrats in Congress have been advocating for, and a version of which passed the House, but has been stuck in limbo in the Senate for months because of a lack of Democratic votes to overcome solid Republican opposition. From Science magazine, earlier this month, they report that Joe Biden got his wish for a new agency to fund high-risk, cutting-edge biomedical research when Congress created ARPA-H, the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, and gave it a $1 billion startup investment. That's a fraction of the $6.5 billion Biden had proposed, but advocates say it's plenty to launch ARPA-H. The 2022 spending bill does not resolve, however, a debate over whether to make ARPA-H a standalone agency within the Department of Health and Human Services or part of the National Institutes of Health. Instead, it gives the HHS Secretary, Javier Becerra, 30 days to decide. That was from Science magazine, referring to the spending bill just passed to fund the current fiscal year. Well, today, Secretary Becerra was asked about the new agency as he testified before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Health. The questions coming from the ranking Republican Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma.
Some of the things that would come to my mind would be, you know, literally, where's the agency staff going to be physically located? What's the timeline for coming? Who's the director going to be? How will the researchers be recruited for ARPA-H? I know we don't want to cannibalize one agency for another. How do you envision the grants being made? All this is a problem, and I do not blame this on you or anybody else, but the authorizing committees didn't do their work. Now, this was the president's top priority. I agree with him on this, but normally that would be, other committees would have wrestled with that, but if we're going to continue to fund this, we're going to have to wrestle with this. And it's particularly going to be a challenge given the amount of additional resources you've asked for. I just tell you up front, from my standpoint, I'm not prepared to do that, even though I'm for the agency, when I have no earthly idea who the director is, where it's going to be located, how it's going to give out the grants, what it's going to do. I know what the NIH does and all those things. And I'm certainly not going to do it at the expense of literally lowering the National Cancer Institute's budget, things like that. So I don't disagree with the kind of spending you're talking about, but I do disagree with the division of labor between NIH and ARPA-H, which seems to me like it's going to have its hands full just getting up and running in the remainder of the fiscal year. So yield that back to you, Mr. Secretary.
Congressman, you've essentially asked the question that we're trying to formulate answers to ourselves. But I will tell you that we've gone pretty far along in announcing that we will have a director that is under my supervision versus NIH is director. What we're hoping to do is show that there will be autonomy. At the same time, because we want it, as you just said, to be able to get up and running, we don't want them to worry about who's going to run HR, human resources, instead of who's going to come up with the next innovation. We wanted to be able to pull on those assets, that infrastructure that's already in place. That's where NIH comes in handy. They don't have to do the administrative work. They don't have to do the human relations, the payroll work, the general counsel work. by standing up all those different aspects of the of a new department or a new agency. What we're going to do is house it at NIH, but actually physically we're looking not to house it within NIH's own structures. We're going to have them separate. It's going to be a very lean, a nimble team. It'll be far smaller than these agencies or the institutes you're accustomed to. There will be program managers, and including the director, him or herself, will likely not be in the job for more than just a number of years, 3 to 5 years, because we want to make sure that everyone knows there's a clock on what you're doing. Unlike NIH, which does that basic research, which could take a long, long time, and who knows when it'll be actually serviceable, what we're hoping out of ARPA is that these are ideas that we can harness right away. Again, very similar to what the Department of Defense did with DARPA, where, you know, the internet that we know today came out of DARPA, those kinds of things. That's what we want ARPA to do. But we need to make sure it's not anchored or tethered to doing things an older way. The program managers that will be hired will know they're on a short time frame to get their work done, and then they move on. And we're going to really have to lean on the private sector to be partners in this, because it's going to be a lean team that really reaches out to folks who are out there doing it right now, and we're going to do it with some support that you all give us.
Well, I don't have much time left, but I would ask that you keep us surprised as you make these decisions. I think we all have a tremendous interest in this and want it to succeed, but look at it with a little bit of skepticism until we see the structure and actually experience some success. So,
Congressman Tom Cole, ranking Republican on the Appropriations Subcommittee covering the Health and Human Services Department, questioning the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Javier Becerra. Most of today's hearing covered the president's budget proposal for the next fiscal year, 2023, submitted to Congress this week. You can find the full video of the hearing at our website, cspan.org. Today is Transgender Day of Visibility, and the Biden administration announcing several measures to make the federal government more inclusive, including gender-neutral Transportation Security Administration scanners at airports. Also, Department of Health and Human Services has a new website offering resources for transgender and LGBTQI plus youth, their parents, and providers. And at the State Department, this from the spokesman, Ned Price.
On Transgender Day of Visibility today, the United States affirms that transgender rights are human rights. We celebrate the achievements and resilience of transgender, non-binary, gender-conforming persons around the world. We recognize their bravery and their hard-fought work for equality, inclusion, and the full recognition of their human rights. We celebrate the diverse expressions of gender and full diversity of gender identities around the world. We also want to highlight, as the Secretary announced in a statement earlier today, the historic milestone the Department has reached in its work to better serve all U.S. citizens, regardless of their gender identity. Starting on April 11th, U.S. citizens will be able to select an X as their gender marker on their U.S. passport application, and the option will become available for other forms of documentation next year. The Department is setting a precedent as the first federal government agency to offer the X gender marker on an identity document. Information on how to apply for a passport with this new option can be found at travel.state.gov/gender. Today and every day, we reaffirm our commitment to promoting and protecting the freedom, the dignity, the equality of all persons, including transgender, non-binary, and gender non-conforming persons around the world.
State Department spokesman Ned Price leading off his briefing. The Federal Communications Commission Chair, Jessica Rosenworcel, telling Congress that updated broadband availability maps, which are necessary to distribute $40 billion from last year's infrastructure law for expanding broadband coverage, those maps will be ready by the fall of this year. She testified before the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Communications and Technology. Here are the questions from the ranking Republican on the committee, Bob Latta of Ohio.
The FCC's broadband maps will be crucial for agencies distributing broadband funds, especially with respect to the $42.5 billion that the NTIA will be distributing to the states through its BEAD program. The FCC is also actively awarding funds for the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund. Chairman, in March 2020, you testified before the Senate that the FCC could radically improve its broadband maps within 3 to 6 months. Congress provided $98 million to the FCC to implement its mapping activities in December of 2020. And since you've been leading the FCC, it's been about 2 years since you've made the statement to the Senate, and yet we still, unfortunately, don't have maps. The FCC recently announced the deadline for providers to submit mapping data to the FCC is September 1st. How long after that date do you contemplate that we're going to have complete maps? And, you know, do you commit to getting these maps done before the end of the year?
Well, the answer to your final question is absolutely yes, we will have maps in the fall. I want to unpack a few of the other things that you mentioned there. You mentioned comments that I made in March of pre-pandemic days. That was a reference to the maps that we used to inform our Rural Digital Opportunity Fund. As you may know, we've had a lot of problems with the preliminary awards in that program because the last administration awarded rural broadband funding to the Pentagon parking lots, the parking lot at LA International Airport, and a whole bunch of traffic medians. The bottom line is that we got to do better than that. And so we have taken advantage of the law that this committee worked on, the Broadband Data Act, which requires us to build better maps. And I think you and I can agree the best time to do that would have been 5 years ago, but the second best time is right now. And my goal is to build the kind of maps that are not just good for the moment we're in, but provide a framework and a structure that people can use 5 to 10 years from now when they sit in this same seat. So we are following that law to a T. We're dotting every I. We are making sure that we do everything that you requested. We have brought in a broadband and data architect. We've acquired systems to make sure we have the capacity to manipulate this data. We've beta tested those systems with wireless broadband maps and new propagation models. And we also acquired, we set up a contract for a broadband location fabric, which is required under the law. As Chairman Doyle mentioned, we got slowed up in that process because federal contracting rules required us to put our pencils down for 100 days. But we were victorious earlier this month, and now it's all systems go. The broadband data location fabric's being built, and in June of this year, carriers will start filing their data with us, and we will convert that data into maps in the fall.
The FCC Chair Jessica Rosenworcel, before the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Communications and Technology, also testifying with other FCC commissioners. The questions coming from Congressman Bob Latta, Republican from Ohio. Political notes, this is the first House Energy and Commerce Committee's oversight hearing of the FCC since September 2020 and the first featuring Jessica Rosenworcel as FCC chair. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more Washington stories sent to you each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Go to c-span.org/connect to sign up. Hope you have a good night.